Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today in Reboot Republic by Dr. Rory Flood, who's a lecturer and researcher in geography, who specializes in coastal systems and human geography in Queen's University Belfast. Rory, thanks a million for joining us today on the podcast.
Lovely to be here, Rory. Yep, excellent.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a bit of crack today because we've got two Rorys going. And yeah. I couldn't help but make the connection and wonder, did your name determine your path of study?
Kind of accidentally. I mean, if it's going for one of these big kind of grand proposals, I might try and throw it in there. If it's something going to like the Fulbright, I probably have to talk about the water and how I followed it. And Om Wil Tilla means follower of the flood and all that kind of stuff. So I've been kind of a follower of the flood for many, many years now. And I think that's maybe had something to do with probably more like some leaving cert results, didn't know what to do, ended up in arts. And through that circuitous pathway, end up doing physical geography.
It's a great one, though. I'd love to. The students must flock to it. We've got Dr. Flood teaching us on coastal systems and climate change. It's brilliant. And also, you're from Offaly as well.
Renowned coastal centre that Offaly is. I mean, part of it, when I tell people, you know, how they end up in doing this, I mean, it could have something to do with the old summer holidays down in Cork Down or County Kerry or a place like that, or just the fact that, like, I saw so much bog growing up. And it's kind of like, I don't want to end up in the bog or searching the bog, because there's loads of people in my field that look at, like, you know, all the quaternary peats and peatland. And I'm like, no, lad, no, done, away from that. Send me to India. Let me look at the deltas out there. So that's kind of where I ended up going, and kind of followed that sort of, you know, pathway to some extent.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. What we're going to talk about today, there's a couple of things in particular. You know, I was struck by, you know, you wrote a blog and you've been highlighting it, the whole issue of precarious work at third level. And it's something that people, you know, I have talked a little bit about on the podcast and highlighted and talked about, you know, my own many years of precarity as well at third level and the difficulty of it and challenges. And I don't think people realize, like, the figures are quite shocking now that we have a half, that's 50% of lecturers at third level universities and ITs in Ireland are either part-time or on temporary contracts. It's reached an incredible level. Maybe do you want to just outline, and we are going to talk as well about coasts and climate change as well. Yeah. But maybe first, just, you know, your own experience around that.
Like, my experience really goes back to the fact that, you know, you get your PhD, right? You're told, get this thing done. Get done in 3 years. If you go to four, make sure you're only writing. And then after that, you know, you have to try and get a job. But the marketplace for people coming out with PhDs is just, it's swamped. There's just so many people coming out with PhDs in very, very, like, niche subjects. So then you're competing for a limited number of jobs. But the jobs can vary between, like my first proper teaching type post was a 6-month contract at in England where I was teaching physical geography. And I got moved up to an extra 3 months was added to it to cover the exam board. And then it was kind of like, right, okay, you're doing this job. It's a few months. What's the next thing to do? Get the next job. So immediately you're in a job, you're finding the next job. When you're in a job, you're still finishing off stuff from the previous job, whatever that might be, research papers, because that's the currency of the academic. It's having the number of papers, the peer manuscripts that you can take, which is your academic passport, they call it, so that you can get in somewhere and then teaching or research. And then you're in this sort of cycle of these, you know, they don't do 6-month contracts as much anymore, but it's more 9 months, maybe a year, 2 years. Research contracts can vary between 1 and 5 years. There's a whole variety of these sorts of employment instruments. From my experience, like, you're kind of going from pillar to post. You're either at job interviews, you're applying for jobs. You're moving around city to city. I've lived all over the place at this stage. Dublin, Belfast, Cairo on stage, Durham, England, Liverpool, which is near Ormskirk, where I used to work. I mean, it's just a whole pile of, you know, one contract after the other. your job then is trying to do enough to try and make yourself essentially employable for a permanent contract, ideally. Yeah. But this is years of your life that's taken out of you. Like, I mean, I was one of these ones, you know, one of these sorts of do the Leaving Cert. I was 17 and then straight into university, 3 years of the undergrad. Crash happened in the middle of that. I was going to do geography and town planning. I did it. And then, the whole world collapsed in terms of Lehman Brothers and all that. And then it was do a master's. That might help you get a job. And then the master's are going worse than the economy. So I am doing a PhD in Belfast. So I was 25 when I finished. And you're kind of great, trying to get a job now. But, that's 7 years ago. And the permanent jobs don't materialize. You follow the path that's kind of detailed by your senior colleagues, your peers. You have to do X, Y, and Z to fit in here. You have to go to this conference. You have to present this paper. But you do all that, and then it's kind of that's you with the next contract to find the next job. So that's been kind of my experience. And I thought I like to detail that because it does have an impact on your rest of your life. I mean, it takes. You lose years of earning power. You lose pension contributions. Your ability to save for deposit is limited. It can affect your personal life. If you're moving around living out of suitcases, it affects your health. And I'm not the only one in this position. Several friends and colleagues, because we always meet, before COVID, we meet at a conference and, where are you working now or what are you doing now and where are you going to next? And the academic circuit just expects you to be, independently wealthy, single, able to move around freely. And that's just not the case. Not in any day and age. It's just not possible. And I think this creates these sort of barriers to people in academia as a kind of a career path. And that's been something that I've kind of experience, and I wanted to talk about on Twitter for a long time because what if I say something that will make it viable? But I've done all the stuff that's made viable and hasn't really worked out the same way. So what am I going to say that's about a market system in terms of how researchers and academics are operating within? I think that's why I wanted to comment on to actually say this is a system that genders these sorts of precarious arrangements, and we need to deal with it. We're not going to deal with the bigger problems later on. You can't deal with climate change or social inequality. You're applying for the next post, for the next position when you're covering teaching or you're covering your last research grant or any number of things. And it's something you kind of really kind of got to me for a long time and something I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, no, there's a whole pile in there. And, I experienced it myself, for many years, this precariousness. And it's something that really, someone was asking me the other day, how often would it be in your head about the job? And I was I'd say maybe 30 times in an hour, I would think about what am I doing to publish? What paper am I doing? What research grant am I applying for? What public output am I making to, and this sense of never been able to turn off at all. And the impact on your family, in particular, and I remember I've spoken about this before, been really, really struck and annoyed by a head of department who told me, it was in geography years ago, that, you should really consider moving to the US. If you want to get, I was in one of these temporary contracts. I was like, I'm fucking kids here. My family is here. I want to contribute to this country. Why the hell should I have to leave? Why can't, an education system that, has poured so much money into me in terms of the PhD, then tell me, oh, just go leave somewhere,
It's a really kind of almost a lazy argument. It goes back to, Lamass and all that kind of stuff. It's a small item. We can't all fit here. And so, how do you have such a highly educated, not workforce, but society that, we've seen the massive social changes. Like in my lifetime, I'm only 32, the changes that I've seen, witnessed, from right back from the 90s, not just the money changes. I mean, the liberalization of attitudes of how people engage with with things like science and how to engage with real social change. And then it's kind of like thrown back in your face, but you don't need that. You just have to go work at Concentrics or something and don't expect to earn more than this. And, oh, by the way, you're going to be on a 0 hours or fixed term contract. I mean, it's like that social kind of, that social contract has really been kind of reneged. And I mean, it's been done, you know, to kind of like, from my perspective, it's been done to kind of, you know, to fit that sort of market neoliberalism that exists. And academia and universities aren't like detached from that. I mean, universities, like, you don't like, people do things because they're passionate about it. They love research. Oh, I love research and I work all hours under the sun. It's like, but you're a worker first. I mean, you get paid for a wage for your work. You're not there at their beck and call. You're not like the, you don't have that same that artisanal approach to research that may have existed in the deep past, which probably didn't exist. You have this, you have a contract with your employer. You're set to do a number of things, but that sort of contract is sort of like, gray. It's sort of grayed out, and it's like, no, you're passionate about it. And by the way, you have to keep up with your peers. You have to publish. You have to go for the highest impact factor. So the stuff that's read by the most number of people, you have to pursue the topic, hot topic issues. So, you know, like, it's not just climate change. It has to be microplastics. It has to be, you know, like back in the 80s, it was acid rain. Now it's another topic. Like, this sort of like magpie approach to pursuing the stuff that's going to get you the most citations, the most visibility, and possibly leading to promotion. That's really like a short-sighted view, because you miss out on those, like, the fundamental stuff. Like, the fundamental stuff, usually, from my experience, it's usually very boring. It's very, very, so my area is sedimentology. I take samples, I look at the grain size, sands of clay, geochemistry, and I spend loads of time trying to fit a model. It's not very exciting, but it's the sort of stuff you need in order to say what you think might be taking place. So you can make the big leaps without the underlying understanding of what is taking place. And I think that's something that's kind of like, now we're kind of missing out on. And because the market demands that we have to chase the most, like, you know, I suppose in terms of your employment, lucrative approach, that, you know, you have to go for climate change, you have to go for the specific topic that really will get you hired or make a name for yourself. That's a really false economy from my perspective anyway.
Because what it doesn't allow for, of course, is that, as you're describing, that slow, you know, buildup of evidence, that research in areas that, as you say, might necessarily be considered the hot topic right now, or and of course, creativity as well. Creativity, you know, where is the space for, you know, actual thinking about deeply about problems and about, you know, and as you say, building up that evidence.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's kind of sad in a way, because, like, my methodology, like, I listen to your podcast with Blind Boy, and I'm always struck with Blind Boy's approach to his writing. He enters creative flow when he's able to come up with ideas. And, like, when I do my research, when I get my head into it,
yeah,
it's like I'm trying to take apart something in terms of what exists and then try to put it together in terms of what I think is responsible.
Yeah. But
that doesn't lead to the papers. That doesn't lead to fundamental. It could be like, well, it's actually the same thing we thought was going on, but it's going on slightly different. And that really doesn't make the big impact. But that's the fundamental line of thinking one has to pursue in order to really deal with these sorts of issues. And it can be quite laborious, can be quite, like, not very exciting, but it's very necessary and important if we're to understand what's taking place. And I mean, that's something that we tend to miss out on, and it's something that really impacts the research then. So that's been my views anyway on that.
I think it's, you know, what I was struck by, again, in those figures, when we think, like, you know, there's, I think in the region of, I don't have the figures exactly to hand, but we'll say half, well, I know it's half of the 2016 figures were half of lecturers. People teaching in Irish universities and ITs were on temporary or part-time contracts, which I think equates to in the region of 6,000, 7,000 employees. Yeah. That's a lot of people who are in this situation.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. And it's like, I mean, you know, if you have half your workforce on these contracts and in these situations, it's like, how are you going to expect the best research or teaching to take place? Like, you're measured on so many metrics that, I mean, you know, it becomes a kind of like, well, I have to do what's best for me. And like that, what's best for you might not always dovetail with what's best in practice. And that's something that really kind of can affect things later on. It becomes a knock-on effect. But like just the fact that we allow such precarity. I mean, precarity is awful. It's a sword of Damocles. I mean, you know, it's just something that it never goes away. When I started working in any contract, I was thinking, this is going to end. And it's going to, you build up so much of a network where you move. So when I moved to Belfast originally, I knew nobody. And within 2 years, I was going to like three weddings in the same year. And
that's just because you're great crack.
Yeah, great crack. Yeah. But when I came back to Belfast, like, you know, back in 2018, like, I mean, I set myself goals, professional goals I want to pursue. But then, you know, like I also had like life goals. Like I met my wife here. Like we moved in together. You know, yeah. I got healthy. I got a whole way of doing of life. And it came down to the fact that, like, in my view, is like you can pursue academia and you can keep going contract to contract and hopefully you might get something, or you can pursue essentially your own life and what that might be. Isn't just going to be writing a paper. It could be like, you know, taking up a hobby. Like meeting people, and actually life is much more enriching for that. And that's something that, you know, like we tend to lose. Again, from my experience within academia, there's a lot of camaraderie because we're kind of all in the same boat, but that means you have a very blinkered world view. Like you expect terrible contracts because that's what is expected from all your colleagues. You expect to be moving around or not develop any relationships in a deep sense. And like that's something change. I mean, you know, but if we can't do it in academia, where, you know, we're supposed to see now in the UK with this big culture war with universities and the Tory government, it's like if we can't change things at the university level, how are we going to deal with societal issues that exist in this respect? And it's just something like if we don't get in the areas that are supposed to be, you know, this actions of championing social inequality, championing kind of all kinds of issues and true liberalism. I mean, how are we going to deal with it later on? And it's just something that I haven't had the answer to yet. And it's just something I can't see happening.
It's interesting because I was thinking about it. You know, I've thought a lot about this and in terms of my own timing, you know, when I look back at what happened, like I came out of my PhD in 2009. So I literally finished the PhD, bang on, crash. And I was working at the time in Dolphin's Barn as a community worker and researcher as well in social housing. And I decided to not pursue academia at that point, but to continue working within the community to support them, try and get through the austerity years. But when I look at people who graduated just 2 or 3 years before me with their PhD, or maybe in 2003, 2004, like they got, you know, permanent jobs. But after the crash, what happened was universities were hammered with austerity.
Yeah.
And so a lot of this precarity is about the generation who graduated with PhDs post 2008, basically paying the price of the crash. Yeah. And then along with this bringing in, you know, something that had been developing in the US and the UK for many years, the neoliberalization of education, which is trying to create these individual economic entrepreneurs as academics rather than being social contributors.
Yeah, because like, that's something I point to when I post about this. Like either the universities are a public good. I mean, public goods always cost more money than they make. That's just the nature of a public good. You have a health service, you have education. You have infrastructure. So either they're a public good and we treat them as such, and that's for the benefit of society, or they're a private industry, in which case that comes with the kind of contractual arrangements, the pay and scales and all that kind of stuff. It's either one or the other, but they seem to be kind of a mixture of the two.
Yeah.
But the worst aspects of the two, they're picking out the precarious contracts, but with the public sector type pay arrangements. They're pushing down the people coming in like last in, first out is usually kind of my experience of it. And it's just something that it is that, that leftover of austerity. But like, this is going on like 10 years now. Like I was out in the Ganges, like when I heard like that the IMF buys were rolling in and the whole bailout of the Republic. And, you know, like we were like, it was just like that. I was 21. Like this, we're still living that legacy of bailout and of these circumstances. But I don't know what, I mean, I get why there's this like almost penny pinching approach to it, but it doesn't engender any real kind of development. And what it does is, though, it's a race to the bottom. So, I mean, you know, we see it the odd time now with UKRI, so UK funded research, which will fund PhD positions. And now they've got these lines in the documents about, like, you know, applicants. So these are usually probably undergraduate or post-master's level students who are applying for PhDs, and they're now asking for publications. And I mean, when I was applying for a PhD, publication, like you read them, you didn't write them. Expectation that not only are you reading them, you're writing them. And I mean, like the system is just becoming this, like, publish, just publish anything, keep it going, get it in there, peer reviewed, signed off. And I just, it's getting more and more from less and less. And I don't know how that's a sustainable model in any way, shape, or form. I don't know how, you know, this has been something to be allowed. Because like the thing I've often thought about is, yeah, you can be annoyed with the situation, with the contracts, with the whole system. But it's like, at the end of the day, this is coming from other academics. It's not like the man, you know, the hidden Wizard of Oz professor behind the kind of curtain. Like, this is coming from, like, it's other academics that have pursued this or have allowed this to develop and have kind of, some have benefited, but many have been.
Do you think it's a very interesting point, because it's something that, you know, there's this argument about, you know, what happened in 2008, 2009, and subsequently was essentially those who were in permanent jobs pulled up the ladder behind them. And of course, it's not completely the case. There is, I think, an element of that certain people in privileged positions, including academics, have no idea of what it is to be precarious, and have somehow, you know, just internalized or, you know, developed these neoliberal ideas and taken them on.
I think it's because partly, like, if it's like this, right? If you've not had to apply for a job in the last 5 years, then your understanding of the job market, even of job applications, is totally alien. Like it's a different, like, to apply for a job is so much effort and so much of your energy that goes into the application, into that pitch, the right pitch, what words do we use, and what we make through the sifting process. And I mean, I think for my view of it anyway, is that there's probably some level of internalizing it is what it is, and that's just the way it is. But also that, some people have benefited from this, but I don't think it's out of any sense of, if the ladder's been pulled up, I don't think it's been done with any kind of malfeasance behind it. I think it's just it's just the way the system sort of allowed that funnel and process to operate, and that's kind of
how. But it's also they accepted, though. That was put on them, the cage of austerity, the iron. They accepted the rules of austerity and said, well, we can't really challenge this, so we have to basically create all these employment. But it also does come from, you know, the funding models as well, that the research funding that's given, you know, it only covers, we'll say, you know, if someone gets a research grant from the Irish Research Council or at a European level, the grant that they then, let's say a lecturer or professor is bought out, they call it, and their teaching is replaced.
Yeah.
Often, my understanding is that the appointment then to cover their teaching is on a much, much lower level. So you have this creation of these yellow pack contracts that, you know, so the funding is a problem as well, the way in which funding is done. And that doesn't come from academics. That comes from
the,
you know, civil servants, you know, the European Commission.
Yeah.
Centrally. So they have driven that as well, that agenda.
Yeah. And I suppose, like, I mean, the kind of, like, you see, they know that the teaching, like, at the bottom line of this is the teaching has to get done. One way or another, it has to get done.
Yeah.
that's just life. You have this sort of captive market of PhD graduates, of postdocs who need something. They need experience, and that's always something being told. But you see, it is part of that funding model fundamentally, because these things didn't exist years ago. Like, there wasn't funding in the 80s for any kind of research. It was so scarce. I mean, but the expectations in research were much less then. You know, like, could go in with a master's in the 70s or 80s and, you know, become a lecturer if you got a job. And then you did your PhD while you were working. And that was kind of the historical approach. Whereas now, because the funding's available, you know, that in itself has kind of been it's a kind of double-edged sword. Yeah, you have money to do research, but that means now that the contractual arrangements are going to be much different. They're going to be essentially predicated on using labor that is there to supplement teaching, cover teaching, or other aspects of the research.
You wanted to bring up the ragged trouser.
Oh, yeah, God. Like, I tell you, my wife's grandmother recommended her to read that many, many years ago. And my mother-in-law read it and my wife read it. And I've never read a book that's fundamentally spoken to me about, like, essentially the how we approach work as workers. And just, you know, just the way it was done. Because I come from a kind of, like, you know, working class background, farming and all that kind of racket. And, like, how people kind of speak to each other and how we approach labour and how we experience that. Like, you read this book and just how essentially that race to the bottom. I mean, I was reading it and just thinking, yes, this is, you know, if you forgive the kind of terminology that exists, but this is the fundamental system. We've gone back to that kind of, you know, like last one in, first one out. If you don't say the right things, if you do say the right things, you might not get the job. Like, this, like, essentially, we don't actually, like, and this gets very kind of lefty, but we don't own, like, really fundamentally the means of our production. The means of our production are our intellectual thought, but that's the ability to do that is entirely controlled by the employer. So that's going to then kind of negate any efforts we have. And the fact then that, like, you know, any kind of action to deal with that, to address that, whether it's industrial or that, that's tied up with the fact that, are you going to take a hit in your wage to go on strike to try and better conditions? And I mean, it's a hard ask for people, for anyone in that situation. And it's just something that when I read that book, and just how it describes working conditions, and, you know, how kind of describes the attitudes, and that, like, why have we never seen that big social change? And it's kind of like that there is that sort of idea in the book that, well, no, we'll worry about, like, we do what we do because that's just the way it is. And we'll get distracted by big ideas like Brexit or this, that, and the other. But the real issues are workplace relations that need to be dealt with. And that's just something that really kind of, I felt, as an academic, that's something I saw in my industry.
It is, I think, incredible that, you know, a book that's written, you know, 1914 published, you know, speaking to you today.
Yeah, painter, decorator, Robert Noonan, you know, like Robert Tressel under a pseudonym. But I mean, like, that going from job to job, like, you might have a skill, like in the book, the protagonist, like, his main skill was being able to do artisanal kind of artwork as part of his role. But I mean, just this, you can read Dickens and you get the idea of, like, deprivation, social deprivation. But, like, you know, like, this book kind of captures that in that real sense, that, you know, having, like, that ability to be so, I suppose, controlled by your employer. And these people, he was describing, like, it was almost semi-autobiographical, like, that the conditions of the work in southern England at the time. It was a case of, you know, your wages were being dropped lower and lower. You're expected to do work, but you're not doing it as well as it should have been. It was always just a botched job, as the book describes. And that's been something that, like, you know, when you're writing a paper, You don't do it because you want to get it perfect. You do it to get it over the line. It's not about making the most perfect piece of work. It's about getting the thing that will get past reviewer two. And that's just something that I've seen, you know, like, that in my experience, been something that just get it done, get it finished. We need to get this over the line to get the next one done. And that's something that still exists. You know, that's 1914, you say, that's still there, still exists for me. And I mean, if I see it in academia, it's everywhere. It's you know, it's the Deliveroo drivers, it's the people in Uber, it's all the different contract arrangements that exist.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's, you know, it's something that is talked about and people are probably more aware of it in different sectors, but they're not aware that it is in academia to this extent. Yeah. And particularly because in Ireland, it is only the last decade. Well, probably now we're heading to almost 12, 13 years of it, but it's really intensified very quickly. And, you know, it's really important that we have this conversation and highlight it. And, you know, I think that it's, I know I was going to talk to you about climate change as well, but we're coming to the end of our time, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, it does affect that, because again, if we want to deal with the bigger issues of climate change, like for example, I sometimes will teach statistics in my undergraduate work, but it's not very exciting. Learning about models is not very exciting, but they're very, very useful. And to have that understanding, like the trade-off for me is, you know, is making something interesting or making something correct in how we approach something as fundamental as using data to understand a phenomena. And like that's then dictated by, well, if I make it too hard or if I go into it in too much detail, that loses the kind of the draw of it. And it doesn't mean it's interesting anymore. And then that can impact then, well, how's your feedback and so on and so forth. And like it's these kinds of things that will come into play, because you know from my experience anyway, the market dictates. I have to make things interesting. I have to make it exciting. I have to make it palatable. But that doesn't always entail what is the most rigorous or robust. And that's something that I think we're going to see later on for some areas. I don't, maybe possibly, but it's just something I've experienced that like we can. You know, like doing the botched job, to use the kind of term from the Raggy Trousers. Yeah. Like that's just something that possibly could exist there if we don't really, you know, outline that properly. So that's just some aspects on that I think will come into play.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very important observation in terms of that idea of a botched job, because as you said earlier, you know, if we've half your staff are temporary or are thinking about how are they getting, you know, the next job or the permanent job, you know, their heads aren't in the teaching. I've experienced that myself as well. It's very hard to be really focused on providing excellent teaching. And also even for permanent staff as well, would say it, you know, the pressure is to bring in research funding for the universities, not necessarily to provide excellent teaching.
But the same thing is dictating this. This is market, the neoliberal approach, how we engage with learning and with research and with knowledge exchange in any meaningful way. If you're doing it as something that's based within market type conditions, it's not the most efficient way. I mean, we kind of fool ourselves in thinking that it's always going to be that way. But usually sometimes these things, like, you know, we have to allow time for things to settle. I mean, it's like Peter Higgs with the Higgs boson, 12 papers. He would never get hired now. He mentions that himself, but his papers were fundamental to the discovery of the Higgs boson. Like we don't allow for that kind of like time for ideas to marinate. And that's the same thing with teaching, with research, with the whole shebang, really, that because the market dictates, we have to publish, we have to bring in grants, we have to teach. That's the only way to do it.
Explain to listeners, not all might be familiar with the Higgs boson.
Oh, it's that back when CERN, you know, the Hadron Collider, when they were bringing together the subatomic particles, trying to find out this special subatomic particle that exists that gives all the standard model of matter or something like that. I'm not an expert, but the Higgs boson was postulated theoretically through Peter Higgs's work, and then later on they found it experimentally. But that was over a case of, I think it was what, 40 years, 30, 40 years, you know, from what he wrote down to what they found out. So things take time, and you don't have that when it's, oh, Peter, that's a great idea you got, but you need to apply for next grant and you need to get in more research funding, or you need to do X, Y, and Z. I think that's something that's really an issue now.
Would Einstein have succeeded in applying for a permanent lecturing post in Ireland today?
I don't think Einstein would have succeeded in applying for most jobs at the present circumstances. I mean,
he would have gone, feck that, I'm going to do something else.
Yeah, like it's kind of, it's it, you know, what makes it, what does make it kind of really kind of a sad situation is there's so many great people. I've encountered so many great people that are just lost to a system that doesn't want them. That just, you know, you're only as good as the papers you have. Forget about any interesting ideas. Like that kind of, that the spark from it is kind of like, it's fading away. And like you lose these people, you never get that back. That's not just, you know, a paper machine. That's someone with some fundamentally interesting ideas that are worth investigating. But all these people just lost to the system. And it's really kind of, it's really sad. And you wouldn't get the like people think within research, oh, it's just like, you know, paint by numbers. It's not, it's creativity. It is a creative process. You need to have that creativity fostered under a system that doesn't punish people for taking time out to pursue that creativity. It doesn't punish them with, you know, precarious contracts or with lost pension contributions or years of earning potential. Like we need to facilitate people, whatever it is. And if we've any idea about any kind of considerations towards social mobility, it does not exist in the current system from what I can see. It's just that, you know, we just don't get that upward mobility of people in engaging within the university system. Because if you want to do that, you have to be, if you wanted to pursue research as that creative endeavor, you have to be independently wealthy from what I can see.
Yeah. And of course, all the inequalities then that continues to reproduce as a result. Yeah. Well, listen, Rory, Dr. Rory Flood, it's been absolutely fantastic to have you on today. I think there's a whole load of, you know, kind of key points you've highlighted that are really something that, you know, I've thought a lot about, and you know, have put them in words really, really well. And it's something that the university and education system and Ireland as a whole has to, and, you know, internationally has to really look at this. How are we, how is our education system operating?
Like, if this is something we're doing now, is this something that, like, what we're experiencing in the global north, is this something that's going to happen in the global south? Are we going to export this marketized model, which just leads to other issues? Like, this is something we need to start addressing now. And it needs to happen like sooner rather than later. That's my experience. These things don't get better with time. If you think precarity is bad before COVID, wait till after we have to pay for the pandemic. And that's something that's going to hit, from my view.
No, I think you're right. And to me, you know, you've summed it up towards the end. The loss of that incredible talent and commitment and, you know, commitment and you know, the personal contribution that each of those, you know, temporary members of staff, part-time, you know, the PhD people who have so much to offer. And of course, it always comes back to, you know, in Ireland, we, as you mentioned yourself, Lamas, there, the willingness to export, you know, that release valve of emigration. And we never value our own, you know, talent and younger generations. And again, you know, I think that really needs to be challenged. But listen, Rory, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rory. Pleasure to meet you. Thanks very much. All right.